Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. In a normal year, when summer turns to fall and eventually the weather starts to get colder, our biggest health concern is getting the flu or even a cold. Many of us will still get the flu or a cold this year, but a much more contagious and potentially serious illness is also a threat. The COVID-19 virus has killed 190,000 Americans and is still surging in some areas. One of the big concerns as we enter flu season is the symptoms between the two illnesses are similar, and influenza can be deadly too. To talk about the flu and COVID-19, and then to answer your coronavirus questions are our guest today, Dr. Matthew Silvas, Professor and Vice Chair of Clinical Operations for the Department of Family and Community Medicine at Penn State Health. Dr. Silvas, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Also, Dr. Jessica Erickson, Pediatric Infectious Disease Specialist with Penn State Children's Hospital. Dr. Erickson, good to have you back on the program.
Thanks for having me.
If you have a question or a comment, and we're going to divide the program kind of into two parts today. First, we'll be talking about the flu and coronavirus, and then, say, in about 20 minutes after 9, we'll be talking exclusively about, well, I shouldn't say exclusively, we'll still answer flu questions, but talk about COVID-19 and answer your COVID-19 questions. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, you can send a tweet to smarttalk@witf.org. At WITF, at smarttalk, WITF. There we go. I've only been doing this for 10 years now. At smarttalk, WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, Dr. Silvas, let's start with the flu and COVID-19. Why is it such a concern of what can happen during the flu season with COVID-19?
Well, I think that there are some unknowns that are probably the highest concern that we have right now. Flu is a dangerous virus that we face societally each year, and not a virus that we spend a whole lot of time talking about in terms of its impact on human life. In fact, in 2017-2018, that flu season, it is thought from the CDC that up to 65,000 Americans died during that flu season, and that's of all ages, with many of the same risk factors that we see with folks who are having challenges with the COVID-19 infection. And so I think the big concern this year going into flu season is, one, if we do have a bad flu season in the midst of COVID-19, that certainly could overwhelm healthcare in taking care of people that are infected. And two, we really don't have a clear idea of what it's like if you end up contracting both viruses at the same time. When COVID-19 struck in the spring, we were probably about 6 weeks or so from the end of our flu season. The precautions we put in place for COVID-19, actually, we saw a dramatic decrease in number of flu cases. We just really don't have a sense of what it's going to look like if patients get both infections simultaneously. And I think that is a reason to be concerned.
You know, I really haven't heard a lot of discussion about this, about people who may contract both viruses at the same time. I mean, is that common that people can contract two illnesses at the same time?
You can definitely get more than one viral illness simultaneously. That certainly happens. The risk in this particular season with COVID-19 is just an unknown at this point in time. So we really don't know, nor do we have an experience of dealing with flu season and COVID-19 at the same time. We really don't have a large experience with that. And so I think that's really one of the primary concerns, and why we're really advocating so strongly for people to get flu vaccine going into the fall, is that we can't really prevent COVID-19 outside of our social distancing measures. We don't have a vaccine yet, but we actually do have a vaccine for influenza, and you can lessen your risk, obviously, of contracting influenza this upcoming fall and winter by getting that vaccine. And that certainly, in this particular year, seems to be would be a good decision for a lot of people.
There are a lot of similarities in symptoms between the two viruses, or at least the symptoms that the patients experience. So what are they? What are some of the similarities, and what are some of the differences?
Well, I think the similarities are the symptoms that people have. So fevers, chills, muscle aches, lethargy, or just feelings of fatigue, certainly coughs and sore throat. There's a lot of overlap between influenza and COVID-19. The respiratory complaints that people get with COVID-19 and how quickly those respiratory complaints can start to dominate their clinical picture is certainly a differentiator. So, but the beginning symptoms of both infections can appear very similar to each other. The challenge is, of course, that in both infections, people can get quite sick and unpredictably sick. And so they're both reasons to make sure that people are certainly in touch with their healthcare provider. I think the concern about COVID-19 is that when people get sick with COVID-19, they can deteriorate really quickly, especially from a shortness of breath perspective. That can be a pretty dramatic shift in how they present, and that right now seems to be somewhat of a differentiator between the two infections. But there's so much overlap. Honestly, they can appear so similarly. It can be very difficult to distinguish one from the other without doing testing.
Well, that leads into the next question. Does that mean if someone presents with these symptoms, which are very similar, and on the surface, you won't know whether it's the flu or COVID-19, that someone will be tested for COVID-19 automatically?
Yeah, I would think that the approach will be and has been that if you're concerned about a patient's symptoms of COVID, that they may have symptoms consistent with COVID-19, that we are doing testing to confirm whether or not they've been infected. The approach this fall and winter will be, we'll also be testing influenza as well. And so it won't just be a COVID-19 test that individuals will get. They'll likely get influenza tests as well, so that we can recognize whether they have one infection or the other, or do they have both infections simultaneously.
One thing that I did notice on the CDC website is they were talking about similarities in symptoms, is that one difference is that COVID-19, and this is something that sprung up very early that kind of sets it apart, is that loss of sense of smell and taste. Now, granted, someone with the flu, if they're all stuffy, maybe they're not smelling like they normally would. But that seems to be a difference between COVID-19 and the flu, that loss of sense of smell and taste.
That's absolutely correct. And for some patients with COVID-19, that may be their only symptom of the infection, which is also really interesting. So, but that the loss of taste and smell has certainly been something that's been talked a lot about, in particular with COVID-19. And that's not related to a stuffy nose, like it would be an influenza or another a viral infection. It's just a pure loss of taste and smell. Many of those patients will get that taste and smell sense back as they resolve from their infection. But that is definitely a difference between the two infections in terms of presentation.
Dr. Erickson, we're going to be talking with you a lot more in the second portion of our program, answering COVID questions. But as a pediatric infectious disease specialist, Dr. Silvis mentioned that some of the age groups or the people who are most at risk for COVID-19 are the same for the flu. Now, there is an exception, though. One difference with COVID-19 is it has really hit older people harder as far as getting more seriously sick and maybe even dying, and those who have a pre-existing condition. The flu has both of those as risk factors, but also young children as a risk factor. So if you would, talk about that with the flu and COVID-19 and whether kids, younger people, and by younger people I'm talking maybe 10 and under, 8 and under, something like that, and their risk for maybe confusing these two viruses.
Yeah, so very similar to what Dr. Silvas was saying, these diseases will largely be indistinguishable no matter what the age group. And although children are much less likely to have serious illness with coronavirus than older adults are, they aren't immune by any means. They certainly can get coronavirus and do. So we're going to be struggling in taking care of children with making that distinction as well. In addition to having a vaccine for influenza, where we don't for COVID-19, we also have a couple antivirals that we've been using for a long time for influenza, where we're still really figuring out what works in as far as treatments for COVID-19. So that's another area where making that distinction can be important, because we, in some cases, using an antiviral to treat influenza is going to be appropriate and beneficial, where if we don't know you have flu, or we think you have COVID-19 and you actually have flu, then we lose out on the opportunity to get people feeling better a little bit faster.
I know that most children have only gone back to school in the last week or so, but there were some students who went back in the last 2 weeks. Is there enough time that you have seen an impact from children going back to school?
No, I wouldn't say that we have yet. And, certainly we've seen in the national media and a little bit in the local media that some school districts are having increased numbers of cases. But I think overall it's too soon to really see a big impact of going back to school.
Okay. So Dr. Silvas, and we're again trying to lay out some of the differences between the two viruses. How long symptoms appear after exposure to infection for flu and COVID-19?
Well, I think I was just reading a CDC update on the presentation of COVID-19. I think that people are most likely to get symptomatic, and Dr. Erickson, I'll see if you agree with this, but around 5.5 days after they've been exposed. So we know that you can certainly become symptomatic after that point in time, but it seems like the lion's share of individuals are symptomatic around that time frame. And then there's a significant percent of people with COVID-19 that are asymptomatic, and they're already shedding the virus, which makes them contagious before they know that they're ill. And some of those patients will never actually develop symptoms, so they'll shed the virus but never actually become symptomatic of the infection. With influenza, it's felt to be somewhat different in terms of people are infectious with influenza, but oftentimes they're infectious whenever they're symptomatic. So there hasn't been quite the same level of concern for asymptomatic shedding of that virus as there has been with COVID-19. In terms of the time frame for when people become symptomatic after they've been exposed to influenza, I think it's similar to COVID-19 in terms of that first week or so after exposure that they begin to develop symptoms. But I think that one of the differentiators here is that real concern around COVID-19 and actually being contagious of an infection that you're not symptomatic of, nor do you know that you're infected, and that silent spreading of this virus has been particularly problematic in terms of controlling its spread. And I think that's felt to be a differentiator between the two infections.
Dr. Silvas, you mentioned very early on about the possibility of hospitals being overwhelmed between the two, between flu and COVID-19. Yeah, this was a big concern when COVID-19 first started, when the pandemic first started. Didn't happen in many areas, most areas. But in a normal flu season, what do you see in the hospital as far as people who are admitted? I mean, do you see a lot of people who are actually admitted for influenza?
It's a great question. So it's not something we spend a lot of time talking about, really publicly, but we do. We have a significant number of patients who are admitted with influenza, especially in the geriatric population, in a typical flu season. The problem with flu season, though, is that they can range in terms of the intensity of the virus and how well the vaccine matches the virus that's circulating in our community. So in terms of total volume of how many people will get admitted in any given year for influenza to the hospital of all ages, it's largely dependent on the strain of virus that's circulating in our community, how virulent or how efficient is that strain of virus at making people feel sick, how effective was the vaccine. Those really have a large impact on the overall number of people that end up requiring medical care, including hospitalization. So it's highly variable year to year. The other wild card in this is how many people actually get vaccinated for influenza. So if we have a really good vaccine, but people are not getting vaccinated for whatever reason, then that really good vaccine is not going to have a significant impact on community spread of influenza. So that's another reason why we're really encouraging people this year in particular to get their influenza vaccine this fall to try to, lessen the risk that person will either get influenza, or if they get influenza, that they won't be symptomatic enough that will require them to end up in the hospital. We really want to preserve our hospitals for the people that get really ill, and certainly COVID-19, we have to maintain a certain level of capacity to make sure that we're able to take care of those patients when their medical needs require hospitalization.
Dr. Silvis, you said that the flu season last spring, ended kind of early because of some of the mitigation strategies used for COVID-19. Is there the possibility that we could have a flu season, maybe not as serious this year because of those mitigation strategies, people wearing masks, washing their hands more often, social distancing? Is there that possibility?
That's absolutely a possibility. And there's a lot of chatter about that right now occurring nationally. And I think that's certainly the glass half full way to approach fall and winter, but it really hinges on individuals making good decisions. So I'm a parent, my wife and I have three children. This year you can't just drop your children off at school with a cough, runny nose, the way people have done it traditionally. That alone, those types of mitigation efforts are also going to help reduce community spread. So the fact that we're not going to go to work sick anymore, a lot of people go in to work when they're not feeling well because they think that that's the right thing to do culturally. COVID-19 has changed that. And so not going to work sick, not sending your kids to school sick, or sending your children to daycare sick, making sure that you're wearing your mask, that you're participating in social distancing, all those different interventions will help decrease the spread of the virus. And they'll not only help decrease the spread of COVID-19, but they also help decrease the spread of other viruses, including influenza. That's what we think we saw in March, April of this past spring. The efforts that we were putting in place for COVID-19 likely led to the end of our flu season early because people were socially distanced because we were all at home. And that didn't allow the flu virus, to continue to spread. And so we could see a really good fall and winter in terms of influenza if people follow the correct precautions. And that's going to be the key.
Dr. Matthew Silvis, Professor and Vice Chair of Clinical Operations for the Department of Family and Community Medicine at Penn State Health. Dr. Silvis, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to answer your COVID-19 questions with Dr. Erickson in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. On tomorrow's Smart Talk, the first portion of the program, we're going to be talking about how restaurants are struggling here in Pennsylvania. And, well, we know that Governor Wolf just made an announcement earlier this week that restaurants can go to 50% capacity on September 21st. But that may not help a lot of restaurants. We're going to be talking about the industry and the struggles that they've been going through during the pandemic and what has to happen for many restaurants to even survive and to thrive. That's on tomorrow's Smart Talk. Dr. Jessica Erickson, pediatric infectious disease specialist with Penn State Children's Hospital, stays with us and will be with us for the rest of the program. You know, we've done this since the beginning of the pandemic where we've tried to answer your COVID questions because new questions pop up all the time. Even some of the old questions are worth repeating. If you have a question for Dr. Erickson about COVID-19 and the flu, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Erickson, I always start one of these programs where we're asking questions about COVID, about what's new, what have we learned recently. What have you learned recently about COVID-19?
Well, we've been learning a lot about the different treatments that seem to work and not work, or work for some people and maybe not others. I don't think we have any firm answers on that, but we're continuing to work through that process to figure out how we can help people who do end up infected with COVID-19. So that's one thing. I think the other thing that has become more and more apparent as we've gone along is the range of symptoms that COVID-19 can cause. We hear the most about the respiratory complications with pneumonia, trouble breathing, needing to be on a ventilator. And that's certainly the set of symptoms that gets the most people in the hospital. But there's been a lot of really interesting side symptoms that COVID-19 also seems to cause. One is cardiac inflammation. We've seen strokes, even in young people. People in their 20s and 30s are having strokes. So it seems that unlike a lot of other viruses that are mostly limited to the respiratory tract, the nose, the throat, the lungs, COVID-19 really gets into most of the body and can cause inflammation and symptoms that can last a long time, even in other body systems, which has been both really interesting and, you know, unfortunate. We would like to see a more limited, easy to treat, easy to get over illness.
When you say last a long time, there have been some people that have experienced some heart issues, maybe had a stroke, blood clots, that have, you know, they have not recovered from that fully, and that it appears that some of these symptoms, some of these conditions could be permanent. Is that accurate?
Yes, it is. And I think that that's something that has been missed in a lot of the public's understanding of the severity of this illness. When we look at the death numbers, those are large numbers, but a person might say, well, I don't know anyone who's died. You know, when we spread those numbers across the entire population of the U.S., you could make a case that they aren't that many. I wouldn't make that case. I think that number of people is something to pay close attention to.
Yeah, 190,000, yeah.
Yeah, that's no small number. But if one would make the argument that, well, you know, young people aren't dying, or, you know, some of these more cavalier approaches to the mortality numbers, we also need to consider the morbidity, which is the term we use for the manifestations of illness that don't kill you. So some people are having long respiratory illnesses where it takes them several weeks to bounce back. This isn't just a couple days cold for some people. It's an illness that knocks them off their feet, keeps them off of work for weeks. Then there's another set of people who have a complication because of COVID that doesn't kill them, but causes long-term disability, like a stroke. A stroke is when you have a loss of blood flow to a piece of your brain, and that piece of brain isn't going to recover just because your coronavirus illness is over. So realizing that there are a lot of people who don't die who do end up with permanent disability or long-term symptoms because of their coronavirus infection is important to realize.
Yeah, kind of what you were talking about created some controversy a few weeks ago when the CDC had first put out a report saying that only 6% of people of the deaths were caused, actually were listed on death certificates as COVID-19. And it's exactly what you're talking about, is they may not have been listed on the death certificate of COVID-19, but their deaths were caused by COVID-19, either a respiratory illness or a heart illness or a stroke, something like that. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. So the way that death certificates are filled out, you know, it's really the reason that caused your death. And for most people, that's going to be respiratory failure, heart attack, because that's the part of your body that stops working that directly leads to your death. However, that respiratory failure, that heart attack, is caused by something. And in the cases of the coronavirus numbers, that something that caused that respiratory failure, that caused that heart attack, that caused that stroke, is COVID-19. These are people who would not have died if they didn't have COVID-19, and now they did. And whether that was pneumonia due to COVID-19 or a heart attack due to COVID-19 or a stroke due to COVID-19, it's, you know, the end result is that they died because they had COVID-19 when they would not have died otherwise.
We have a question from Terry who asks, as a person over 75, when should I get a flu shot, now or wait until late September or early October?
That's a great question. The flu shot immunity doesn't last super long. That's why we have to get it every year, because it kind of wears off in a sense. So if the flu season ends up being particularly long and you got your flu shot particularly early, it's possible that for some people it will wear off before you stop needing that protection. On the other hand, for most people, the flu vaccine is going to last long enough, and we really want to encourage as many people as possible to get the flu vaccine this year for all the reasons that Dr. Silvis outlined so well. And one point that we didn't touch on is that a lot of the ways that we've gone about giving flu vaccines, like the table at the entry of your grocery store, we're not going to be doing a lot of those flu vaccine opportunities because of coronavirus concerns. So in order to get as many people getting a flu vaccine as possible, I would encourage you to get yours as soon as you can. The theoretical benefits of waiting are not worth the possibility that you would lose your opportunity just because getting flu vaccine is going to be less convenient this year than it has been in the past.
Let's take a phone call from Laura in Palmyra. Laura, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I came in late to the conversation, so I hope we didn't cover this, but I've understood that, in addition, you were talking about the long-term effects and how everything kind of, first that it's a vascular, it's more of a vascular, where they thought originally it was a respiratory thing, and secondly, there's this long haulers syndrome that it's not just the effects of how people have died from COVID-19, but the people who have survived, and they have extended depression, this kind of lack of wanting to do things, all hooked up with the depression, and such things as COVID-19 onset glaucoma, COVID-19 onset high blood pressure. And why I've heard this mostly because of Chris Cuomo, who talks about this because he actually had it and he's experienced this now, but I don't hear a lot of talk about it nationally.
Mm-hmm. All right, Laura, thank you very much for your call. Dr. Erickson, what about that?
Yeah, I agree that that's something that we haven't put a lot of emphasis on. I think that's largely been because it's a little bit difficult to capture that. Death is a clean endpoint, as we might say in research. You either died or you didn't. And so it's much easier to capture who is dying and who is surviving rather than, you know, who has glaucoma from COVID versus who has glaucoma because they were just going to get glaucoma anyway versus who doesn't have glaucoma. It's more difficult to capture all those numbers, especially on a national or global level. But those things are definitely happening. The long hauler, that's kind of the term that's been applied to these people who continue to have symptoms for weeks and weeks and have, you know, a really slow recovery.
So depression is something that many people have experienced, glaucoma?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So those are two things. You know, there's so many things that we don't hear about. We hear about the respiratory illnesses, and I think part of that is because of, you know, the rush to try to get ventilators for so many people very early on. You know, I ask you as we started about some things that have changed. I understand, and you tell me, since you see this every day, that those who are treating patients with COVID-19 are less likely to put patients on ventilators today, correct?
I would say that we are. So if a person needs a ventilator, they'll get a ventilator. But patients are less likely to need a ventilator now than were at the beginning of the epidemic, and that's because we have gotten better at taking care of these patients over the last several months. So we have some additional strategies to help keep people off of ventilators, to get their body and their lungs doing what they need to do without having to get onto a ventilator. Mm-hmm. But we aren't saying you are too sick for a ventilator or you don't deserve a ventilator. That's absolutely not happening. So it depends what you mean by less likely to get one.
Yeah, and that's what I did mean, is that the patients were being treated differently, but if they were sick enough through a respiratory disease that they would get a ventilator.
Yeah.
Have another email here from Lee says, I understand that flu deaths are usually not counted on death certificates. The federal government apparently estimates the number of flu deaths each year. Is that correct?
So so flu deaths are reported on death certificates in the same way that coronavirus deaths are. So a death would be listed as pneumonia due to influenza. So it really depends on the doctor taking care of the patient at the time they die to fill out the death certificate completely and accurately in order for the death certificate numbers to reflect what's actually happening. The caller is right in that flu deaths are typically estimated, and that's largely because the death certificate numbers are incomplete. We don't test everyone for influenza, and it can be hard to make those associations a little bit. So the numbers that we use for how many people died of flu last year and 5 years ago are typically estimates extrapolated from the number of people that we know for sure died of flu.
Let's take a phone call from Faith in Lancaster Township. Faith, you're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you.
Yes.
As a person over 70, I'm wondering, what does the doctor recommend or know about any special immunity boosting nutritional aspects or whatever? I know there's no magic bullet, but is there anything someone like me, a senior, can do to boost our immunity? And I'll turn off, shut up now and
radio. Hey, Faith, thank you very much for your call. And I think what Faith is referring to is fighting the flu, but also whether you can boost your immunity toward contracting COVID.
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. And I wish I could say, oh, yes, just order this cocktail here. But we don't, there's nothing as simple as that. The best answer is just to get good nutrition. So eating lots of fruits and vegetables, as much as possible from actual fruits and vegetables. If for some reason you can't eat those kinds of things, or you just really hate them, can't eat them, then doing a multivitamin to take their place or juice would be better than nothing. But as much as you can, whole fruits and vegetables, whole grains, brown rice, good nutrition is going to give you the biggest bang for your buck. With COVID-19 in particular, there are some suggestions in the lab that maybe zinc might give some benefit, but we haven't seen that in big studies in people yet. So, you know, taking a little extra zinc is unlikely to hurt you. We don't know yet if it helps or not, but there's some theoretical reasons to think that maybe it will. But just plain old good nutrition and exercise, actually. Exercise makes your immune system work much better. So getting out every day to take a walk around the neighborhood, that actually makes your immune system work better. So that would be the biggest thing.
So basically what you're saying, and I think you used the term, or someone used the term magic bullet, I think Faith did, there is no magic bullet, it's just what we normally would do for a healthy lifestyle.
That's right. Yeah, these healthy lifestyle things, good nutrition and exercise, they actually make your body healthier, as it turns out. Yes.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Also coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk, Jay Paterno will be with us. Jay Paterno has written a novel. It's fiction, a work of fiction. It's about a college football coach. No, it's not about his father, about a fictitious college football coach. But Jay Paterno also is on the Penn State Board of Trustees, so we'll talk about the decisions that have made at Penn State relating to COVID-19 and the sports in the fall. That's tomorrow in the second part of Smart Talk tomorrow with Jay Paterno. We're answering your coronavirus questions right now. Dr. Jessica Erickson is pediatric infectious disease specialist with Penn State Children's Hospital. We have a few minutes left. Give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Erickson, Bob says, if I get a flu shot, will I have a raised temperature for a day and not pass a temp screening?
That's possible. Most people don't have much fever. Most people don't have much symptoms at all. But fever is one of the most common signs that your body is responding the way that it should to the flu shot. So that is possible. So you might consider getting your flu shot on a Friday afternoon or another time where the not getting through a temperature type screening would be a problem for you.
I do have a question about that, though, about taking the temperatures. NBC had an interesting piece last night where people who were confirmed to have contracted coronavirus, COVID-19, were taking their temperatures. And the majority of them, almost all of them, had a normal temperature of under 98.6. So they were not seeing any raised temperatures. I guess the question that came out of that is, does it really do us a lot of good to be taking temperatures wherever we go?
The shortest answer would be no. It does not do us a lot of good. It probably does us some little good, because about 80% of people who have COVID-19 will have fever at some point. So that's 20% of people will never have fever. And the people who do have fever, they don't have fever continuously the whole time they're contagious. So it's absolutely right that temperature screening is going to miss a lot of people who are actually contagious. But having it as one piece of our prevention efforts, with masking, with social distancing, with good hand washing, with staying home when you know you're sick, it's just part of that package. And does temperature screening probably provides, it's probably the least useful piece of the package.
But see, what you just described, though, is I think may give some people a sense of confidence that, oh, I don't have it. And I don't think this NBC piece was recommending that we not take temperatures, but just what you said, that it's just one piece, but it's not the only piece, and maybe it's not even the most important piece of screening for COVID-19, but really for a lot of employers, a lot of places in public businesses, it may be the only way that they can do it, other than making sure that people wear masks and social distance and that kind of thing, right?
Right. So not having a fever doesn't mean you aren't contagious, but having a fever means that you are more likely to be contagious. So if we can get rid of all the people who currently have fever, that reduces the number of people who are in the setting that are likely to be contagious. It doesn't take it down to zero, which is why we need all these other measures.
Let's take a phone call. Let's see. Mike is in Camp Hill. Mike, you're on the air.
Thanks a lot. It's a great program, as always.
Thank you.
Two quick questions. Vitamin D. I read an article from a respected scientific journal, I believe, called Elemental. If I understand correctly, I got it from a friend. And in this article, it's talking about a supercomputer analyzing COVID. An interesting new theory has emerged. The article was September 1. And one of the things it suggested is taking a dosage of vitamin D daily. My first question is, what is a high, safe dosage for a person such as myself who has cardiovascular compromise with stents? Can I safely take, for example, 2,000 IU a day, or I shouldn't go that high? And secondly, can you comment on vitamin D as a potential based on what you have seen or heard or read in the literature?
Dr. Harrison?
Yeah, so I would suggest you talk about your particular dose with your physicians, since they know your medical history in more detail and could give you advice that's specific to you personally. But in terms of vitamin B just in general, vitamin B certainly has a lot of theoretical ways that it could be beneficial, similar to zinc. But also similar to zinc, we haven't really studied that in people to know whether it helps or not. So most vitamins taken in reasonable quantities are safe. Whether they're effective or not, we really don't know.
Okay, now are you saying vitamin B or D?
D, like D, dog.
Like
D
dog.
D as in dog. Oh, okay. Yeah, so I did misunderstand the letter, but my comments are really the same. So vitamin D has been shown more with vitamin than vitamin B to be helpful in decreasing just bacterial pneumonia. Like, there are a lot of studies looking at how vitamin D is helpful in preventing or reducing the severity of infections actually in people. That hasn't been done as much in to date in COVID-19. But there is a lot of evidence to suggest that vitamin D is helpful in preventing or reducing infection. That's mostly in people who are vitamin D deficient, getting them up to a normal vitamin D level is helpful. If you already have a vitamin D level, taking super doses of vitamin D probably isn't as helpful as replacing the vitamin D if you're deficient. So that would be something else to discuss with your doctor about whether vitamin D would be appropriate for you.
What is a super dosage?
Right. Mm-hmm.
What is a super dosage? Is that your question, Mike?
Well, she mentioned the word super dosage and not to overdo it beyond a super dosage. What did she mean by super dosage? What is a daily super dosage?
Well, I don't mean anything in particular with that. Just taking a lot of it, two or three times the recommended daily allowance, would typically not add anything to you beneficially wise, and could start to get you into the range where you're taking too much.
Hey, Mike, thank you very much for your call. Yeah, my family doctor has been, he said that there's a real kick now from, I don't know if it's for insurance companies or what, but because there's so many people who are vitamin D deficient that it's being recommended more often. So, Dr. Erickson, we only have a couple minutes left. Anything that you'd like to let people know, maybe something that's not getting a lot of attention when it comes to COVID-19 that they should be thinking about?
Well, I guess I feel obligated to make another plug for masks, that this is really the best tool we have at the moment to keep yourself and your friends and neighbors and family members safe. Because of what we've learned over the past several months about asymptomatic spread and pre-symptomatic spread, you really don't know that you're not infected today when you spend a lot of time in close quarters watching movies or eating dinner with your friends and neighbors. You may become ill tomorrow and realize, oh, yesterday when I was with all my friends, I was actually contagious. And since we can't live life in reverse and go back and forth in time, when we know these things, it's really important to act as if you are contagious all the time. And that means wearing a mask when you go to the store, when you're hanging out with your friends and neighbors, really anyone who doesn't live in your household with you. It would be the neighborly thing to do to wear a mask when you're around other people.
Dr. Erickson, there's so many people we've heard that are relying on an effective vaccine. There's no guarantee that there will be a vaccine that will come out of this, right?
That's right.
So is there any reason, I guess the question is there any reason you have as a medical professional to be optimistic at this point of, the next few months for COVID-19?
Well, I think we've all gotten better at doing social distancing and masking, and we've rearranged our school lives, we've rearranged our work lives, and the more of us that can continue to do that, the better off we're all going to be. I think in terms of things to be optimistic about, we can be optimistic that we'll get a vaccine that is safe and effective, but we're not there yet. We don't know that's definitely going to come.
I mean, one of the things that just personally I think about is that everyone kind of is looking for a magic date. Like I keep hearing people say, after the first of the year. Well, we don't know that. I mean, the first of the year may just be New Year's Day 2021. There may be nothing different that day.
Yeah, I think that's true. We've made a lot of progress so far in preventing deaths and treating people better. The death rates, if you end up on a ventilator, are much better now than they were a few months ago. So I think that we'll continue to make progress and do better. But I think it'll be a gradual thing. I don't think it'll be a switch flipped where we all go back to our old lives again.
Dr. Jessica Erickson, Penn State Children's Hospital, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.